This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're doing Every Time a Bell Rings. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want us to ruin it for you, you might want to pass on this one, and we will see you next time.
Are you ready
for one dry kiss?
Ooh. Hello there, Brian Adams.
I put a little pepper on it.
Thank you. On to old pop culture references. That was from the Brian Adams Three Musketeers song from the movie from the 90s. So throw back, 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 back. Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy irreverent love letter to Hallmark movies, where we recap.
We're rootin' and tootin'.
One glorious Making the Yuletide Gay in July Hallmark Christmas movie in the month of July. We are doing Every Time a Bell Rings. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. And I would like to introduce you to my lovely co-host, the woman who gives me wings when that bell rings, Miss Tamara Cosio.
And I am here with the bell of my ball, the ringing in my ears, the ding to my ling, Corinne Edding.
Ooh.
The ding to my ling was what I was laughing at when we were doing it. I was like, the ding to my ling. Ah, I crack myself up.
Can I introduce you one more time?
Of course.
Okay. And I am here with the woman who rings my bell, rings my bell, Miss Tamara Cosio.
Are you going to insert that instead of your first intro?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Oh, you have to outdo me. Oh, of course you have to outdo me. You got to do a little song styling. Damn it. Ugh. I thought it was so clever. All right. Okay. I'll see you.
Uh-huh. Your intro was lovely. I'll soak it all up.
And then I'm going to soak it and bounce it right back at you in song form.
Ooh. Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
So I have to tell you something, Corinne.
Oh, please do.
After doing these notes.
Uh-huh.
So the last episode.
Yes.
I took some chunky bits that very well should have gone to Corinne because I am doing the outline entirely on my own and we are not collaborating on the split.
Yeah.
So there were some nice parts that I got that Corinne didn't. So this time I was particularly heavy-handed with giving you good parts. And I think you got probably 3/4 of the outline. It's yet to be seen, but I was like, holy shit, that's Corinne's. That's Corinne. That's Corinne. Okay, well, I was giving her 3 spots to my one. All right.
Well, I think that you needed a little break after the weekend that you had because you had a lot going on. And so that maybe was a good thing. Also, all I wanted was in the last one moment, just one. That would have been really nice. Mm-hmm. So you know, I wasn't asking for all the moments. It doesn't need to be like split equitably right down the middle or bathed on me, but just, you know, a shining moment of glory.
You know, you've got 17, I think, in this one.
I got a lot. I was like, damn, there's a lot going on in this movie. type.
So we're going to, it's yet to be seen in this episode if Corinne's doing 75% of the talking, dear listeners, you know why.
Can we talk about how much was going on in this movie?
There was so much going on, as you will see. A lot. A lot, a lot, a lot.
I was like, in this 5-hour episode of One Dry Kiss, we will cover Every Time a Bell Rings, and I have no idea how they crammed all of this stuff into this hour and a half.
How many times does the bell ring? Well, according to our count, 3,500,076 times. That's how long it takes to get through all this stuff. But it's not bad. It's not a bad movie. Do not get us wrong. We will get to the end of the Dry Kiss rating, but there's just a lot. A lot.
But before we launch into things, I have important Ryan Pavey news because Ryan Pavey and I are about to run off into the sunset together. You understand that, right?
Would you like to borrow my car that's named after him?
For sure. I think that him riding shotgun in a Honda Fit is totally his style.
A Pavey and a Pavey.
A Pavey on and the a Pavey. Pavey. Oh, Pavey cubed. Nice. So I watched the movie a couple of weekends ago, 2 Tickets to Paradise, and I tweeted, and Ryan, Rye, responded back to me.
You're not even a first name basis. You're on a nickname basis. Nickname. Wow. Yeah.
Coco and Rai Rai in the hizzy. And and so, you know, I was like, he's obviously wooing me. He said, right? Question mark, exclamation mark, question mark.
Side so where are you registered for your wedding?
You know, Crate and Barrel. Yes. And Sheetz, the company store. Thank you
very
much.
Ryan didn't really participate in the choices, so it's mostly mine. But, you know, I think we have the same taste. Yeah. And he'll like whatever I like. Yeah. It's fine. It's fine.
I've got really good taste, so it's all good. You know, it's not like too frilly or anything like that. It'll work well for him. So I was like, obviously he's wooing me. Then he posted this week, in case some of you folks need a reminder. And then he reposted this thing that said, the treatment for an ectopic pregnancy is abortion. The treatment for a septic uterus is abortion. The treatment for miscarriage that your body won't release is abortion. If you can't get those abortions, you will die. And I was like, Ryan, thank you for sharing and speaking out.
Mm-hmm.
So he won brownie points on that one as well. Wooing me times two through reproductive choice. And just gentle listeners, if you are interested in resources or contributing, you can go to, and I heard this from MFM, but choice.crd.co. I typed that in and it takes you to donation pages for National Network of Abortion Funds by State, National Bail Fund Network, and Jews for Abortion Access. So, yay! All the stuff.
So Ryan Pavey spoke to your heart and your uterus.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I am ready for action and show me what we got from Crate and Barrel for our wedding registry, obviously.
I love those sheets with the little green and blue fishies on them. Those are adorable.
That's from the company store. That's the other place where we're registered. That's for our sheets, yes.
Although I have no doubt that your taste is flawless, especially if you're registering at Crate and Barrel. I have a sneaking suspicion that Mr. Pavey might like want to register at a gem store or some jewelry making store.
You're just acting like you know him and stuff.
I do follow him on Instagram and I have seen his jewelry. That's all I'm saying.
He does make the jewelry. I think that you're onto something there. I can't wait for the basket of gems you're going to give him at the joint bachelor-bachelorette party that we have.
You know me too well. And those gems will be strategically glued all over my naked body.
Oh
I'm sorry, Corinne. Were you going to be here? Oh, I'm totally not trying to steal your man. No, that's not happening.
Coming up on my man.
Can't we share?
You're like, only my car is named after him. Back off, bitch.
I know. I got it first. I called Diz. I don't care. We texted you. Okay, this is getting weird. Let's stop. I feel like we're going to get into a middle school hair pulling fight at any second. And we are grown ass women for the most part.
Look, you just don't want to get into it with me because I don't have that much hair. So it's going to be easier for me to win.
Uh-huh. I got my shit tied back. I'm East San Jose style, girl. It's back, it's high, and it's not easily accessible.
You're like, my eyebrows are appropriately arched. I am ready.
They're always arched. I can't help that.
No, your eyebrows are beautiful. Oh my gosh.
I don't want people thinking I'm like cholaing them out, like making them like up to my hairline and back down. Like, she already had beautiful brows. Was she going for more? I think that might be a mistake.
She was not trying to Ronald McDonald her brows. Fear not, gentle listeners.
Mm-hmm. So you know how the eyebrow trend now is really thick?
Yeah.
So I just put everything like up, like everything. I tattooed them. I added about 2.5 inches and it's all above my existing eyebrows and it is glorious.
Speaking of glorious, there was a client who came into the office and I was like, your eyebrows are glorious. They were beautifully shaped. And she's like, I got my eyebrows done in San Jose. It was hella expensive. She got them microbladed, but they looked good. I've seen some microblade and I was like, you look like a porcelain. You got porcelain doll eyebrows. Fantastic. But hers, you could not tell. They were,
you look like hair plugs looking for men happened all over your face.
So I'm just waiting for the time when I like we get on video chat and suddenly you have these like lush brows and I'm like, what happened? And you're all microblade, bitch.
I'm afraid because that's so permanent. And yeah. I have seen the doll hair eyebrows, doll hair eyebrows.
Yes.
I mean, I draw them in anyways. And I remember I was talking to some guy on one of the dating apps and he's like, you have really nice eyebrows. And I was like, thanks. I pencil them in. The 90s were not kind to them. And he goes, oh, I know. And I'm like, I don't know how to take that.
Okay. Fuck you. Like, yeah. What?
Yeah. He's like, well, I know you draw them in. And I'm like, well, so you're saying I'm good at coloring, bitch? Like, what are you saying? I get in the lines okay? Like, great. Thanks a heap, Chet. Anyways, are you and your eyebrows ready to get into it, Corinne? Do you have a synopsis?
Why, yes. Yes, I do. And it's long. Do you know why it's long? Because this is a particularly complicated
movie. There's a lot going on. In-
You know what I was thinking when I was, like, watching the movie
I know what
again?
You're going to think.
I was like, oh my God, I'm so glad I don't have to do the synopsis. Gentle listeners, this is all my fault because I did not look at the outline till it was too late. And then she accidentally gave me a synopsis again because we usually rotate. And I was like, motherfucker, this synopsis is going to be
so theoretically, I was supposed to do the synopsis and Corinne was supposed to do the fun facts and I was supposed to intro, but I flip-flopped it because I misplaced a week. And so she's like, great. Yeah, I was so jazzed that I didn't have to do the synopsis and the intro. And guess what? Well, fucking joke's on me. And I'm like, sorry. Yeah, Tamara's fired.
No,
Tamara's
I totally
from doing the outlines.
And it was all my fault because if I had been acting like the partner that I was supposed to in our relationship, I would have looked at the outline and would have been like, oh, we just need to swap around our initials and it will be fine. But I didn't.
I think part of that blame still falls on me because I'm the one that did it. I know that you didn't catch it, but I am the one that did it. So
yeah,
I'm taking a little bit of this one.
You can take a little bit of it, but like really, you know, I don't expect perfection from you and you don't expect for perfection from me, hopefully. And we have a system of checks and balances.
That makes one of us.
So that when I edit an episode, you can be like, Corinne, what are you doing here? It sounds like there's five people talking at the same time and there's only two of us. And then I can be like, oh, shit, I made a mistake. So, you know, we help each other out. And I was not doing what I needed to be doing. Anyways, longest synopsis of all time. Okay, gentle listeners, hold on to your hats. Three sisters celebrate Christmas for the first time in years with their mom back home in Natchez, Mississippi, for the first time since their dad died. The sisters are in their 30s and their relationship isn't the best. While they're home, they go on a scavenger hunt, just as they did when they were kids, to find the wooden wishing bell. Their dad wrote out one last set of clues before he died. P.S. The sisters are all adopted. Now, not done with the synopsis yet. Charlotte, played by Erin Cahill, is the oldest, and she, because each of these sisters has their own distinct, fully fleshed out storyline with different dramatic moments in it. So this is bananas how the person who wrote this fit all that in. But Tamara's nodding at me. Charlotte, played by Erin Cahill, is the oldest, and she has some kind of building nonprofit job that takes her all around the world. She is the most out of touch with the family, and once she's home, she has to figure out how to reconnect with her family, juggle her childhood crush on Liam, played by Wes Brown, and possibly reach out to her birth mom for the first time. Emily, played by Brittany Ishibashi, is the middle sister. She works in tech, and her husband Paul, played by Ryan Sands, has recently opened a bakery. They're trying to get pregnant, and Emily's heart is heavy. She has something she needs to share with her husband, but so far hasn't. It's a mystery. And Tamara's very glad that I've brought that over from our month of mysteries, I am sure. And finally, the youngest is Nora, played by Allie Liebert. She is living at home since her board game coffee shop failed and is trying to find her way. However, when she locks eyes with Maisie, played by Lindy Greenwood, there is a chance that she may just find her way to love. Will the sisters get into a hair-pulling fight? Huh? You were very apt with that. Will the sisters ring the bell? Ring the bell, or find the bell. And will the sisters create a tower of Legos to the ceiling, just as me and my sister used to try to do as kids? Keep those listening ears listening to find out.
I'm very disappointed that you repurposed my song for your synopsis. I thought that was my special Ring My Bell song, and then I hear it again, and I'm like, oh, less special now.
Yeah, I was all about just making it less special. That was just for you. No. No. I was just carrying an awesome reference for you out amidst the synopsis of it all.
Letting it linger on.
Yeah. Just reminding everyone subliminally of the greatness of Tamara. Speaking of the greatness of Tamara, what has Tamara found for us in the world of fun facts? Facts, 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 facts.
I have a shit ton because you said your synopsis was robust. So, Allie Liebert, who plays the little sister Nora,
yes,
is a lesbian in real life.
Yay!
And plays one in this movie.
Yay!
She came out a while ago, and in 2019, she tweeted that she's played lots of lesbians on TV, but playing Betty McRae, who is also a lesbian on Bomb Girls, helped her come out as a queer person.
Aww.
And she sent all her love out that day to her lesbian fam and hoped they felt seen and heard and loved.
That's a beautiful, nice, fun fact. I love that.
This is absolutely not a fun fact about Erin Cahill, but it's a brag about myself.
Ooh.
Because I figured out that she was, one of her first roles was cast as the Pink Power Ranger in the Power Rangers Time Force, the 9th series of the Power Rangers franchise. And I just wanted to put out there that one of my first OK Cupid dates was with a guy who acted in a couple of seasons of a Power Rangers spinoff series as a teenager. He will remain nameless for privacy. We only had one date, so I did not get to see him in his leotard, and I was very disappointed.
Oh, I'd be very disappointed as well. Maybe that's why you only had one date, because you were like, where's the outfit? Where's the outfit?
That I kept saying, go, go, Power Ranger. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, I'll have a coffee, please. I was trying to find a fun fact about all the sisters, and I was having a hard time finding anything about Brittany Ishibashi.
Uh-huh.
Until I went on her Instagram account, and I was scrolling her through her pictures, and I saw her wearing a shirt that said, I am American. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I read the little bio that she put under the pic, and it was a sweatshirt that was inspired by the Matsuda family. Back in the Second World War, they commissioned these shirts after the bombing of Pearl Harbor because they wanted to remind their neighbors that they were American, aww, even though they were Japanese American. And they were still forcibly sent to internment camps, as well as Brittany's grandparents on both her mother's and father's side. So wow. Her maternal and her paternal grandparents both got sent to internment camps and spent 4 years out in the middle of the desert. Is this a fun fact? No, but sometimes it's an indication of what people in higher up power positions making bad decisions and doing things to people that they should not be doing because they have no business doing it. Harkening back to what Corinne said about reproductive rights. Sometimes people make the wrong decisions and we should learn from our mistakes, not repeat them. Just
yes.
Saying. I'm talking about Roe versus Wade. And lastly, the city of Natchez, Mississippi, where our lovely story takes place, was named after the Natchez Indians, who in fact built a fort for the French colonists, and then shortly thereafter took the fort back because they realized they were fuckers, driving them off for years and years. So I just wanted to make that not a whitewash episode or not a whitewash story like we did in our last one about the Marmots. So
I didn't know about that. That's awesome. But I really appreciate learning that.
So wow. They're like, get off my fucking land. And they literally got off their fucking land. So
nice.
Last fun fact was from Lance Harris, director of the Grand Village of the Natchez Indians. The other ones were from IMDb and Wikipedia.
Those were fantastic.
Shall we jump in, Corinne?
Yes, I am ready.
I'm ringing the bell to start. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling.
We're in the small town of Natchez, Mississippi, and three girls, Charlotte, about 10, Emily, about 8, and Nora, about 6, are stopped with their bikes in front of a giant tree. Charlotte reads off a small scroll. You've come to the end of the scavenger hunt. The wishing bell is close. You may need a boost, which you've probably deduced. It is found in the park's biggest oak. Charlotte and Emily boost Nora up, and Nora struggles to reach the knot in the tree. As the girls are doing this, 10-year-old Liam cruises by on his bike and offers to help, but Charlotte smiles shyly at him, saying, "No thanks, Liam, we're good." Finally, Nora reaches the bell. "I've got it!" And next thing we know, the girls are running into their family's woodshop. Every year, they go on a scavenger hunt for this wooden bell. It's a magic wishing bell, which is pretty epic. But before they ring it to make their wishes, Nora demands that their dad tell the story of the bell. Their dad, Robert, tells them about how, as a kid, his grandpa gave him a bell for Christmas Eve that was carved out of the wood of a magnolia tree. Dad says, "I opened the box, and the bell still smelled of magnolia blossoms. My grandpa said to me, 'When you want something real special for Christmas, and you know it in your heart of hearts, make a wish, ring the bell, and the gift will find its way to you.' So I closed my eyes, rang the bell, and wished for something I really wanted, a tool set, one I still use to this day, and every Christmas since, I've made wishes." The girls all take turns with the bell, taking a moment to make their wish and ringing the bell. 25 years has passed, and the family is gathering together for Christmas. It will be the first big family gathering since their dad died. Mom is running the wood shop, and apparently she's also a welder, a woman of many talents. And can I say,
that Mom was a badass bitch.
She was a badass bitch. And the actress, Dee Wallace, who played her, fantastic. Her acting chops were on point. She was so good.
All of the casting was good, I think, in this movie, but I do agree with you. Mama Donna was amazing.
Yeah. And yeah, I felt like everybody did a good job in this, but she was just so good.
I also appreciated the young Mama Donna. It was believable that that was her back in the day.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. But we're 25 years in the future now. Nora, the youngest, is unemployed but has been doing some work at the family business, updating their payment processes, creating an online inventory, and making a website. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, Emily, the middle child, and her husband Paul, who is helping to improve the name of Paul's, as Tamara and I both don't have a great track record with Paul's, are...
Don't ever date a guy named Paul.
No. It was a bad idea for the both of us. We're just saying.
Not you, just us.
Just
doesn't pertain to you, especially if you have a husband, boyfriend, or a very good life partner named Paul.
Yes, absolutely. But we're just a little scarred in like real legit ways by Paul's.
Mm-hmm.
But this Paul, he's a good one. And they're packing to leave. It looks like they live in a studio apartment. Paul, who has just started his bakery, is bringing his sourdough starter with him, and Emily is pounding away on her phone trying to fit in last-minute work at her startup company. Paul enthusiastically mentions that he's bringing along prenatal vitamins just in case. And I'm like, ease up there, Paul. Even if you find out she's pregnant a few days without prenatal vitamins won't hurt her.
I was going to say, how long are they going for? 5-6 months? Wait, do you really need the prenatal vitamins?
He's a little overeager.
Are they for you? Uh-huh. Yeah. See, that makes me worried for Miss Emily, though, because say she gets pregnant, whenever that may be, and 3 or 4 months along, is Mr. Paul going to be like, I've got the doula in the stirrups just in case? Everywhere they go.
Probably. Yeah. There'll be the car that they drive around in, and then there'll be a little sidecar attached to it with the doula holding stirrups hanging out the side. I'm ready.
I have the prenatal vitamins.
We're ready for our prenatal vitamins. Maybe she has a thermometer like my mom bought me.
Oh, my sweet baby Jesus. I bet you they do.
Paul encourages Emily to try to make amends with her sisters. If they have a family, he wants their kids to have aunts they can talk to. Emily wants that too, and she'll try as long as they try. Meanwhile, across the world in a mystery country, Charlotte is leading some kind of building project. She gets a call from the Mississippi Children's Bureau. They have the pre-adoption records that she's requested so she can find her birth mom. Charlotte requests they send the papers to a friend as she'll be traveling. Shh. Secrets.
Shh. Secrets. And where's Charlotte going? Why, she's returning to Natchez, Mississippi. Woo-hoo. After a long absence. She gets off the bus and is met by Liam, her childhood bestie, who is sitting on a staircase playing What Child Is This on his guitar. Ooh. With her name propped up in his case. So she recognizes him. I guess she's been gone that long. She walks up and is impressed, as well she should be, because not only is he the most popular band for Natchez 50 and up demographic, he's also been tasked with setting up the Christmas by the Bay displays. They get into his pickup truck and drive to Charlotte's familial home. She tries to coax him inside as a buffer. Things have not been great between her and her sisters in the last few years. They resent her for living a million miles away. Everyone's butthurt that Emily eloped and didn't invite them. And nobody got to go to Nora's game cafe before it went out of business. There are hard feelings all around.
Mm-hmm.
Just then, Mom runs out on the porch and yells, "I thought I heard Liam's truck! Ah!" Her and Mom have a warm reunion and make their way inside, with Liam following close behind, carrying her bags.
Hmm.
Just then,
can we
Emily,
talk?
Nora, and Paul enter from the opposite.
Can we talk about her bag? The fact that it's the size of a child's suitcase? It is.
It's like a carry-on bag. And not even a carry-on bag that you take on the airplane. It's like half the size of a carry-on bag.
Yeah. It is tiny. I'm like, I know that she's a tiny woman, as in, like, she's tall, but she's very lean. But still, I don't know how she could bring enough clothes. Like, it, you could have a bigger backpack than her bag.
That's one thing that always ticks me off when I come to visit you. No offense, Corinne. Uh-huh. But every time I'm packing and only want to take a carry-on piece of luggage, I put one shoe in there and it's fucking full. And I'm like, God damn it. These bags are not made for girls with size 10 feet, I'll tell you. Son of a bitch. It's not even my clothes, because I am not a petite woman by any stretch, but the shoes. I can bring not one pair of shoes. I could bring one shoe if I have a carry-on piece of luggage. And that's it. The ones I'm wearing, and then I'll be hopping around Oakland the rest of the time I'm there on my other shoe, because the other one won't fit.
Look, you need to wear them as earrings on your ears, so that way, since they're an accessory, they won't count as a carry-on. The shoes, not the
right
bags. Yeah.
And then that'll definitely deter anybody from sitting next to me, so I guess that works on multiple levels.
It's a win-win. I'm looking out for you, Tam.
Great. I'm just gonna knock myself out when I sneeze or something, accidentally get a concussion. But no, that sounds like a grand idea. Just then, Emily, Nora, and Paul enter from the opposite side of the house. Mom cries, "You made it! Oh, all my girls are here!" They stand in the foyer awkwardly, giving each other stiff smiles, until Liam can't take it anymore and pushes Charlotte towards the group and yells, "Merry Christmas, y'all!" This spurs everyone to hug and finally greet each other appropriately. Mom is busy in the kitchen finishing up dinner and yells at Nora, "Help the girls upstairs!" As they make their way to the old rooms, they start bickering. Somebody has a bracelet that looks like somebody else's bracelet, and they accuse each other of stealing it. Liam hears this and pulls Paul aside and says, "If things get too heated, I'm only 5 minutes away." Paul brushes this off. "I'm sure I can handle it," he says confidently, but Liam shakes his head. Little does he know what the Daniel sisters could be like. He looks at him intently and hisses, "Only 5 minutes away," and rushes out. A little later, around the dinner table, everyone is catching up. Emily is doing some sciencey stuff at her new sciencey business, saying molecules, biometric something something science.
Yes.
And her company is hoping to go public next year, so she is a busy gal. Charlotte asks Nora how she's doing, but before she can finish, her little sis interrupts her and says, "What, since my business tanked and I had to move back home? I'm trying to get the family business into the 21st century by making a website."
Aww.
And Mom agrees that Nora's been a huge help. Charlotte's face falls, and she tries to switch gears by asking about her girlfriend, Vanessa. Nora's face tightens. "I wouldn't know, since we broke up 6 months ago." Again, Mom tries to break the tension by chiming in, "Oh, Vanessa was too needy anyways," and everyone chuckles. And then Paul asks about the family traditions, the Christmases they had in the past, and of course about the magic wishing bell. Does it still come out during the holidays? Epic fail, Paul, because that question instantly turns everyone kind of sad and somber.
Aww.
They haven't used the bell since their father passed away. Yeah, Mom says, they used to do a scavenger hunt on Christmas Eve, but they retired after high school. But there are still plenty of family traditions and memories, Paul, that we'd be happy to share with you. Emily points her fingers up and says, like Christmassippi mud pies at Smoot's. Nora and Paul are in, but Charlotte declines. She doesn't want to go. She had a long trip and is jet-lagged. Emily and Nora tease her. Of course we're going to do exactly what Charlotte wants to do, because that's how it's always been. Mom tells them to quit it. She's going to stay home with Charlotte, and they can all catch up while everyone goes to Smoot's.
Smoot's is housed in a cute cabin where you can order at the window and sit on surrounding picnic benches to eat. As Nora waits in line to order, Paul and Emily play a game of cornhole and chat. Emily advises Paul, if my dad were here, he'd tell you to order the Rob Special, not the Fudge Blondie. Paul doesn't know what the Rob Special is, but he's smart enough to take advice from the dead, so he yells over to Nora, can you change my order to the Rob Special? Nora is thrilled. Yes, I knew you'd come around. The woman in front of Nora in line, who is about Nora's age, turns around. I looked at the menu and I don't see the Rob Special. Nora looks at her with a twinkle in her eyes. That's because it's not on the menu. My dad made it up. It's basically the Christmas Mississippi. You're better at saying Christmas Mississippi than I am. I was very impressed.
Christmassippi.
Mud pie with extra cream. You can't go wrong. The woman whose name is Maisie smiles softly back at her. I'm here with my mom. Why don't I let you order for us? My mom is a big foodie, and I wouldn't want to steer her wrong. Nora and Maisie have a cute moment together, and it's clear that there's a little something-something between them, if you know what I mean. A little later, back at home, the sisters come back from dessert with Paul, who is high on sugar. He loved the dessert and must have the recipe. And Emily pushes him towards bed, but stays downstairs to decorate the tree with Charlotte, who got a second wind after talking with their mom.
Do you think she really got a second wind? Because she's like, I'm too tired to go. They're like, it's tradition. No, I'm really jet-lagged. It's tradition. No, I'm going to stay here. Because mom finally like comes to her defense and says she'll stay. Yeah. And then she gets a second wind. I'm like, did she just not want to go with them?
Yeah.
I kind of got that impression because I would be a little more pissed than Emily was if I woke up and she's like, I got my second wind and decided to clean the house, make the tree, wash the dishes, and I did 3 loads of laundry. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was like, if she legit got a second wind, I can understand. But it's also like a bit of a sketch situation. I am feeling mm-hmm. what you're putting down.
Yeah, I would be a little bit, I would be, I think, more offended than Emily was. Oh, you got your second wind? I'd be like, really, bitch? Really? Now I can kind of see like where all those hard feelings are coming from because I'm already mad at Charlotte and it's only like the fifth scene in.
Nora heads to the fridge to chill mom's dessert and Charlotte turns to the ornament pile. When she sees the box, the bell goes in. Charlotte and Emily look at the box tenderly and Emily says, we have to put out for dad. That's a bad. No, no, gentle listeners. This is not that type of movie.
Is it one of those cults? Like those sex cults? You have to put out for dad?
This is not a lifetime going? Non-Christmas movie.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay.
Oh my gosh. We have to put out the bell. For dad. Let's add a few more words to that sentence, shall we? Charlotte opens the little chest and no bell, but there's a scroll. Ooh! Both scream, Nora! And once Nora gets there, they open the clue. It's just like their childhood all over again. I sure hope this Christmas is merry and bright as my 3 girls come home and at last reunite. I don't have much time, so I think I'll be blunt. I've made one more holiday scavenger hunt. I assure you, it's real and not just a dream. I wish for my girls to go out as a team. If you choose to proceed, and I hope that you do, look down below for your first Christmas clue. The sisters put their hands on top of the other sisters' hands. Sister power activate, they say. And maybe they said a more sentimental, for dad, is what they probably really said.
We got to put out for dad.
Yay. No. The bell.
Every time a bell wings, a uterus gets its wings. Yay! Yay!
The next day, the girls get their old bikes, adjust the seats, pump the tires, and ride out to solve the first clue of the scavenger hunt. Here you go with your very first clue. Work together to be a good crew. Head to a spot that never failed to delight our prized Christmas view with holly in sight. Charlotte thinks it's the Grand Hotel. Emily thinks it's the Magnolia Grill, and Nora thinks it's the bridge. They agree to go to all three when they encounter Liam. He's surprised to see the three of them together. If I didn't know better, I'd think you were on a scavenger hunt. They affirm this and ask for his help, but no. He shuts them down. You remember how many times I offered to help you out in the past and you turned me down? I'm sorry, y'all. You're on your own. Emily smiles. We got this. Let's go. And they bike off.
Girl power.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Liam.
Yeah, we don't need you, Liam. While the sisters run around solving clues, Donna, a.k.a. Mom, and Paul are in the kitchen. He's helping her with the sourdough starter, and she apologizes that he's been left behind as he gets so little alone time with Emily. He's super supportive, though. Are you kidding? I'm thrilled that she's running around with her sisters. He just wants Emily to bond with her sisters and hopefully come out of this whole experience closer with them than before.
Meanwhile, back at the scavenger hunt, the sisters have exhausted all three of their scavenger hunt guesses. The clue wasn't at the Magnolia Grill or the bridge or the Grand Hotel. They contemplate, how could have Dad swung this? These clues have been sitting here for at least 2 years. Charlotte proposes they go back to the Magnolia Grill to get some shrimp and grits so they don't lose steam. Nora grabs her arm excitedly. Steam! She yells and points at the steamboat docked at the pier a short ways away. The American Duchess steamboat. It has a great view and magnolias! Have they solved it? Have they? They hurry over to the pier but realize the last ride has already been given and they're closed for the evening. Emily and Charlotte look as if they're about to walk away, but Nora jumps the chain partition. Is trespassing your new pastime? Emily asks incredulously, but Nora is adamant. They've been searching all day and they need that clue. Mm-hmm. She tells Emily to stay behind and stall anyone that may come along, but Emily argues, I'm a horrible liar. No one's ever going to believe me. So Charlotte gets to be the lookout and the staller. The two younger siblings hurry off. They only have three stories of steamboat to look through. Easy peasy. And before they get too far, Captain Ron comes up the pier, returning to the boat. Charlotte hisses at her sisters, take cover, while she intercepts him at the partition. She stalls him by getting him to talk about all the boats that he became a captain on. Tugboats, steamboats, pontoon boats, rowboats, speedboats.
Okay.
While Nora and Emily scurry around the third deck. This has to have the best view, but there's no clue in sight. Then Nora remembers, Captain Ron, he let us steer the boat that one time. There's one more deck, and that's a better view than here. They race up the stairs to the top. Charlotte's finally having a hard time detaining the captain because he just needs to get on board to grab a Christmas present that he picked up for the missus. And just as the sisters get to the top, they open the captain's control panel and they find the clue just sitting there. Has it been sitting there for 2 years? That's what I want to know, because it looks like it's a fairly frequently used control panel. There is a steering wheel and lots of instruments that I imagine are used to steer the boat. So, is Captain Ron opening that control panel, scooching that little clue aside for the last 600 and something days and steering the boat? Thoughts, Corinne?
I'm just saying, Santa always has helpers.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Nice holiday
reference
explanation.
I know.
I like
right?
it.
Yeah.
So the sisters race downstairs just as the captain heads into the wheelhouse and they just missed each other. The girls are giddy as they race off the dock, clue in hand.
I'm surprised you know that it's a wheelhouse. I'm impressed.
It was a building that he walked into, and that's the only building that I know is on a boat. So I just guessed.
Wow.
It could have been the seating area. It could have been storage. It could have been the bathroom. I don't know. I just said wheelhouse.
Look, the fact that you used a somewhat nautical ship term, I'm impressed. Yes. Meanwhile, across town, Nora is enjoying a cupcake at Butter Cakery when Maisie enters with her mom. Macy's mom thanks Nora for the mud pie recommendation and leaves them to peruse the menu. Nora and Maisie make hard eyes at each other while talking about the website Nora is making for the woodshop. Nora puts on her big girl pants and smoothly asks Maisie if she'd like to go out sometime. Maisie says yes and writes down her number in Nora's notebook. Call me, she says with a smile and hard eyes, and then leaves to join her mom. Finger guns, finger guns, finger guns. Yes, Nora. Yes, Maisie. That's how it's done. That's how you just ask someone out.
I don't think I've told everybody that I was a huge paper hoarder as a kid. And so when she like flipped three pages over and she's like, I'm going to put my number right here. And I'm like, on that fresh page, on that whole empty, look, I got a little corner here that's got some space. Why don't you write your number right there? You don't have to waste a whole page for that. Even a hottie that was giving me their number, I'd be like,
That's so that you can draw hearts all around it.
Mm-hmm. No, I would not be. I'd be like, think that I'm not calling her now. She just wasted a whole page of paper in my notebook.
Tamara's done with Maisie now. She's ruined everything. I get it.
I realize it's a weird thing. It's one of the weird things where I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot I have that. But in my defense, I did not have a lot of drawing paper when I was growing up, and I had to be very creative in where I got my artistic rocks off. So when I got older and could afford paper, I hoarded it, and I have like 50 half-filled notepads scattered around my house because there are still blank pages of paper in there that I could potentially use, hopefully before I'm 70, but as many books that I have, I probably will not get to it.
If I had known, I would have like given you some of our paper stash. Gosh darn it. You know I wasn't above stealing things from my household.
I did not know that. And had I'm regretting like so all the years that we were together.
I know. Wasted time.
Could have been drawing a pollute. I know. Imagine how good at drawing I'd be by now if I had that paper.
Oh my gosh. I am responsible for the fact that you haven't, like, become the next Leonardo da Vinci. Damn it!
Yeah, I know. They call me Tamara Degas.
Later, the girls are together in the shed. They have their next clue. Picturing y'all is music to my ears, spreading all kinds of holiday cheer. You'll help out our town near twinkle lights that dangle, making the perfect Christmas triangle. The sisters toss back and forth ideas, and then Emily sees three triangle instruments on the wall and grabs them. You know why Dad said triangles were special? They have three sides, just like the three of us, and they come together to make perfect pitch. Emily hands a triangle to each sister and imitates their dad.
Together, y'all can do anything. You just have to support each other, especially singing.
Suddenly, Nora's brain hamster screeches to a halt on its wheel. That's it. It's caroling night. The sisters have got to sing. And, of course, they have their Christmas sing-along in the coolest place ever. Well, it's Longwood Plantation, and it's not that cool because Holler Nut, who had the largest octagonal house in the United States built, owned over 800 enslaved people, and the building itself was partially built by enslaved people. This building that they're in was in the process of being built when the workers found out about the war, the Civil War, and hoofed it on out of Dodge, leaving everything behind. Only the basement was finished, which is what the family ended up living in. Anywho, we're not in the basement, wow. Though. We're on the ground floor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just hear me out here.
Yes.
We don't have anybody, no slaves to build our house. We have a basement. So instead of bucking up and building the rest of the house ourselves, we're just going to huddle in the basement and stay there forever because we don't want to soil our hands. Is that what you're saying happened? I can't get dirt under my nails.
I don't think that they had the skills to build it, nor do I think they had the money to, because this guy was in the cotton industry, and although he was pro-union, I'm not exactly sure how he was pro-union with 800 slaves, but he was. the Union Army destroyed a bunch of his fields and everything like that, and yeah, so he got fucked, but I don't feel too bad about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay, I'm okay with that. Okay with that story. All right, live in the basement. You do you.
In one of the things I read, it said, and he died 2 years later, some say of heartbreak. And I was like, yeah, not feeling too sad.
You know what the life expectancy was back then? Don't try to make it all dramatic. He died of tuberculosis. Shut the fuck up.
But if we ever go to Natchez, Tammy, I want to see that place because it looks hella cool.
Okay, as long as we get to sing the Natchez song that they sing.
Oh my God. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to reenact the Natchez Christmas song. Anywho.
That's why I gave you this part. Emma Corrin's for sure going to sing the song from start to finish. No?
No. No. We're not in the basement.
I didn't give you enough? Okay.
Yeah. We're on the ground floor of this octagonal brick building, which has a huge open space that the Carol sing-along is happening in. Charlotte has asked Liam to meet him there, and blammo, he is there with his band, the Natchez Nachos. Liam announces. How do you feel about that band name, Cameron?
Is his last name Nacho? I was so...
Nachos are like a delicious cheesy treat.
Great. Yeah, uh-huh. No, it's a delicious cheesy treat, not a great name for a band.
Yeah. Liam announces the sisters and says they're doing tonight different by singing Robert's favorite song, Natchez Christmas Eve. And apparently the town of Natchez has its own Christmas song, which is a claim to fame in itself. Charlotte isn't sure if she can remember the lyrics, but fear not, Charlotte, your sisters have got your back. Nora starts off and locks eyes with Maisie while she sings, who is in the audience enjoying the singing with her mom. Emily picks up the second verse, making eyes at Paul, her hubs, and smiling warmly at their mom. And Charlotte brings it home with the chorus while she sings pretty much exclusively to Liam. As Charlotte and Liam make heart eyes at each other, Nora and Emily notice the heat between Liam and Charlotte and smile.
Maybe it's all those nachos that Liam ate. His namesake band, Nachos, you know.
I get it.
I'm sorry. I don't mean, I'll come sorry.
I get it. Unless those nachos have sour cream and guacamole, I'm not interested. Just saying. And everyone sings, and I apologize to anyone who might be listening from Natchez, Mississippi, because I'm going to slaughter this tune-wise.
Yes! Yes!
No matter the weather, it's just you and me together on a Natchez, Mississippi Christmas Eve. Everybody, on a Natchez, Mississippi Christmas Eve. Yay! The crowd goes wild. And when they look in Liam's guitar case, which was fielding tips, gasp, there's a scroll. What kind of trickery is this? Shh, secrets. The next day, the sisters ponder the next clue as they sit around the kitchen table waiting for breakfast. Nora reads, "Find the spot we capture joy with every passing year. Then off it went around the world to spread our Christmas cheer. Above the big river with a 360 view, posing is vital to earn your next clue." Ching, 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 come on, Vogue, ooh, ooh. Let your body move to the music, move to the music.
Gentle listeners, Corinne is voguing. I'm not sure if she's doing it good or bad. I'm pretty sure.
Bad. Very badly.
Okay. I mean, I'm impressed.
What if they had like gone up into the gazebo and they had done good and they had vogued? That would have been amazing.
I know. Now that I saw you doing it, I'm like, I think that was a missed opportunity right there.
Totally.
Why not have two musical scenes? They sing the Natchez Mississippi Christmas song, and the next one they make up a fucking routine to Vogue by Madonna. Look it up if you haven't heard that song.
Oh my gosh. Dancing, incredible. So they're mulling over the clue while Paul puts the finishing touches on his beautiful snowflake pancakes. He comes out of the kitchen and announces proudly, "And now for my famous snowflake pancakes." He presents the beautiful platter of snowflake pancakes to the sisters when suddenly Nora shouts out, "The gazebo at the bluff!" The sisters excitedly jump up and scramble to get out the door while Paul stands there confused. Emily dashes up to him, grabbing handfuls of the pancakes and says, "I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you." I'm not sure if she's saying it to the pancakes or Paul for being infinitely patient while being ditched once again for sisterly bonding. But Mom encouragingly says to Paul, more for us?
I have an absolutely not important question. Huh. Snowflake pancakes, they are pancakes made in the shape of snowflakes. Yes. And before they put them onto the plates, they sprinkle them with powdered sugar. Do you think that they put syrup on top of the snowflake pancakes or just eat them with the powdered sugar?
Syrup? Hello? Pancakes? Yes.
Okay. 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 Just checking. Because I was like, that sounds amazing. Wait, do they just eat them? Like, because she just took them in her hand. Emily said, thank you. I love you. I love you. I love you. And grabbed a handful of pancakes and like exited stage left. So I was just like, eh.
Well, that's because she took the pancakes to go. However, guess who wouldn't just be running out the door? I would have been like, y'all go on ahead. I will meet you there. I've got some snowflake pancakes to attend to.
Yeah. Oh, I have to go? You're like making me go at gunpoint? Then I'm going to get a little dipping bowl and I'm going to put some syrup in it. And I'm going to take it and dip the pancake in the syrup as we go along.
Ooh, dipping bowl. You're good. They have baskets on the front of their bikes. There's no reason why there isn't room for a dipping bowl.
Right?
Yes.
Right?
You are a genius.
Jesus.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you. I like my sauces.
Yes. Yes, you do. Ooh, like a Marionberry syrup. Mmm. Yes.
Oh, stop it. You better, I'm just, nope. Too late. I cannot eat this late. You better stop it. We're talking waffles last time, and now snowflake pancakes. This is just not fair, having these breakfast food conversations at 10 o'clock at night.
Mm, with a little sausage. Okay. The sisters arrive at the
Quit it.
The sisters arrive at the gazebo, which is on the edge of a park that has tons of Christmas dioramas in it. Kids run around gleefully checking everything out and partaking in the Christmas spirit. The gazebo overlooks a big river and has a big red Santa chair on it, as well as a large decked out Christmas tree. Fortunately for the sisters, Santa is on break, so they can run up to the gazebo to look for the next clue, and they can't find it anywhere. They gather around Santa's chair defeated when Santa's helper approaches them. You know, if you want help recreating that photo, I'm happy to help you. The sisters are puzzled, and Santa's helper clarifies. You know, like the one on the tree. And lo and behold, there on the tree is a picture of the sisters all together in red plaid Christmas dresses looking ready for the holiday. And attached to that, their next clue. It's a mystery.
A little later, Charlotte rides her bike to Liam's place. She pulls up to see him working on a Christmas display and says, 4 days from Christmas and you're still fixing the displays? He shrugs. The mayor asked, I have to fix this one specifically because it's from the 50s and it's in pretty sad shape. But I gotta do what I can. He invites Charlotte to join him, and she doesn't think it seems like a proper date, but he offers to make cocoa and put on some Christmas carols to make it more festive, so she agrees. When they're knee-deep in the project, he asks her what she's going to wish for on the wishing bell once they find it. Charlotte gets contemplative. I don't know if I want to wish for anything, she admits. When I was a kid, I wished for the same thing year after year, and it never came true, so I stopped. Liam wants to know what the heck she wished for. Mm-hmm. And she finally divulges that it was to meet her birth mother. Not like my parents weren't enough, she explains. I just wanted a sense of her and who I was. Liam understands and says, well, I hope you get that wish if that's what you still want. Sidebar, this yes. whole storyline kind of threw me off because everybody that I know that's adopted has had very extensive conversations about their adopted parents, mm-hmm. whether they want to meet them, whether they don't want to meet them,
right.
you know, like speculating wildly about how they are. And so the fact that the one thing about this bell, every time a bell rings, is like nobody talks about that and they all act like it's new information and they only looked or thought about their biological parents later on in life. And that just kind of was.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Anyways, now back to the story. Mm-hmm. And suddenly he remembers that he got something for her in the mail. He pulls out a thick manila envelope with her name on it and she knows exactly what it is. Her birth parents' address. She excitedly grabs it, paces around, trying to be nonchalant. and then chucks the information into her jacket and returns to the display without telling him what it was. Later that evening, the girls and their mom are at the piano bar assembling gift boxes filled with local wares. Nora picks up a teddy bear and snuggles it, commenting on how cute it is. And Mama Donna looks at Emily pointedly and says, "I can get an extra one for you if you want me to." Everyone's a little confused until Mom admits that Paul shared that they were going to start a family soon, and she is thrilled. Emily, on the other hand, is not so thrilled. She's not thrilled about the pushiness. She's also not thrilled because she doesn't want everybody to know about it. Nora changes the subject and asks, "Do you think Paul's helping with the scavenger hunt?" Emily scoffs, "Pah! Paul would never..." But Nora persists. "He's awfully curious about the family traditions and the clues and everything around it." "No," Emily confirms. "He's not helping with the clues. He is clueless."
Oh.
"Sorry, not sorry," Nora says. "I just love a good mystery." "Weren't you writing a mystery novel?" Charlotte asks. And Noah nods. "Yeah, I was." Emily's confused. "How did I not know that?" And Nora chastises her. "Well, if you ever came to visit me at BU... Things start getting catty quickly until Mom cuts that shit off. "Girls," she says, raising her voice, "this is a charitable event, so why don't we try being charitable towards each other?" They agree, and it's peace on earth and in the piano bar once again. Later that evening, the girls are sitting in their bedroom looking at photo albums and reminiscing about their childhood. Charlotte, remembering her paperwork, asks both sisters if they ever tried to reconnect with their early foster families or birth parents. Emily had no desire to look for anybody, and Nora got in touch with her birth parents briefly in college, but didn't keep in touch because I have my family right here. Emily and Nora snuggle into each other with their shared belief that the Daniels family is their only family, while Charlotte looks on concerned. Just then, Nora's phone buzzes, and she tries to lean away from her sisters while she texts. But the older girls are relentless. They pepper her with questions. "Who's that? You guys already texting? Are you guys going out? Are you going on a date? Did you ask her out?" Nora smiles and admits that she did ask her out, but it's more like a hangout, not a date. Her sisters are thrilled. "Well, since it's not technically a date," Charlotte starts, "we should be there," Emily finishes. "We'll wear costumes, fake mustaches, monocles. She'll never know we're there." Nora's not having any of this. She does not need her sisters at her sweet, sweet hang with Maisie. The whole conversation erupts into a little pillow fight, and Nora pelts her sisters into submission. She's going alone, alone, alone.
That's what she thinks. This is like conversations that we've had where I've been like, "So tell me when and where you're going to be for your date so I can be there." And you're like, "You're not going on the date with me." And I'm like, "But am I?"
"Okay, I don't have to be there, but all you got to do is tie your phone around your neck with a lanyard and then point it out so I could see everything that you're seeing and what's going on and happening." And I'm like, that would not be awkward at all.
No, wouldn't be awkward at all.
"Hi, this face nestled in between my boobies is my best friend, Corinne." "Hi." "Say hi, Corinne." "Okay, she promised not to talk at all for the duration of the date. She just wants to be here."
"But if there's any awkward silences, don't worry, I'll put in some fillers."
Then 2 minutes later, "Say, what's that on your plate? What are you eating? That looks delicious. Corinne."
Yes.
Short time later, Mom finds Charlotte in the woodshop sanding a rocking horse. She remarks that there's probably not a lot of creativity when you're dealing with 2x4s and erecting buildings. Mom asks nonchalantly how the scavenger hunt's going, and Charlotte admits that it's going pretty good, even though they had a couple of sister moments. Mom nods and says, "You guys have been apart longer than you've been together at this point, and it's going to take you a while to get on the same page and be good teammates." She gazes intently at the rocking horse, and Charlotte says, "You want to help, don't you?" And Mom chuckles, "Yes, yes, I do," as she grabs a piece of sandpaper and joins in. I wish I knew somebody that likes sanding. Sometimes those projects, I'm like, it's going to be not smooth because I am done doing this.
Yeah, we just need to find Mama Donna so that we can get her to fill in on that mm-hmm. part.
And then be like, "Oh, my hand's so tired." "You barely started." "But my hand is so tired." "Don't you want to join in, Mama Donna?"
"Look, I'll sing the sanding song. A sand, a sand, a sand, a sand, sand."
That's the sanding song you came up with, you lyrical genius? I'm going to give you a moment. I'm sure you could come up with something better.
What? Anywho, the girls hop on their bikes and read the next clue. "Every display of the Christmas bluff has a special place in my heart, but this might be my favorite one made with you girls in mind from the start. The sisters look at each other and all say, "The three angels!" They ultimately figure out that Cain Weller owns it, and they go to visit him at the church.
This is the part, gentle listeners, that got Corinne a little tear jerky.
Oh, God, yeah. Emily and Nora happily head off, but Charlotte doesn't seem thrilled at the prospect of going to the church. They find Mr. Weller playing the organ at the church, and immediately my eyes well up, thinking about my sister's service. I'm like, I cried.
They had an organ.
I cried several times throughout this movie, and this was a big one, and I cried while scripting out this portion because my sister liked to sit and listen to the organ play until it finished at the end. Mind you, our organ player at our church is a badass. She liked to listen to the organ play, so they're just sitting in this church talking about the dad and the service and the organ's playing, and I'm like, ah.
And Corinne texted me, and I'm like, note to self, Tamara, make sure there are no church scenes with organs in this outline that Corinne needs to do. Check, check, check.
No. I don't mind. It's okay to cry. It's okay to cry.
She's saying no, but she's nodding emphatically into the camera.
Sand. And Charlene is also having the feels. The sisters take a seat in their dad's pew, and while Nora and Emily are nostalgic, Charlotte is incredibly uncomfortable. As the sisters sit in the dimly lit sanctuary listening to Mr. Weller play, "Oh, little town of Bethlehem," on the organ, Charlotte suddenly apologizes to Emily and Nora. "I'm sorry I left after the service without saying goodbye." That's awkward. Nora glances over at Charlotte, who is looking straight forward, and Emily looks down at her lap. Everyone is feeling some serious feelings. Charlotte continues, "It was too hard. It was like if I stayed too long, it would be like he was really gone. And so I did what I do best. I just kept on moving." Nora nods her head and says softly back, "That was hard. It was hard." Emily says with pain in her voice, "It really was." And Nora continues, "We know that everyone grieves differently." Emily concurs, "People aren't always in sync when they lose someone." Seriously, I agree with that. Grief makes people very unpredictable, and you just have to give people a pass for being giant flaming assholes sometimes.
You sure do. I am not speaking about anybody specifically on my end.
No, not at all.
Just being completely vague. And we're not referring to anybody in particular.
No.
Please edit that so I sound smart.
I totally
we are not
will.
Referring to anybody in particular.
Charlotte, choking up, says, "We should have been together, though. Missing Dad, loving Dad, as a team. I let y'all down, and I hope that one day you can forgive me." Emily looks Charlotte in the eyes. "We still have a lot of life ahead of us to be a team." Nora nods her head. "Yeah." She puts out her hand, and the sisters pile their hands on top. "And it's all for one, and one for all."
I still don't recognize that damn song.
Finally, they meet Mr. Weller, who remembers buying the three angels carving from their father, but he donated it some time ago when his wife passed. They asked him where he donated it to, but Mr. Weller says that would be cheating. The girls chuckle. He's in on it. He tells them they can just keep their heads up if they want to find it. And Nora realizes that he is literally saying, "Sisters, look up!" And in the sanctuary, on a stand or a shelf or something, is the carving with, ta-da, a scroll attached.
Ooh.
I know, very exciting. Back at the family house, Paul and Emily are talking over baking. Paul thanks her for encouraging him to open the bakery, and Emily says, "You would have done it regardless. It was in your heart." But he is doubtful. However, there is one thing that Paul is not doubtful about, and that's having a kid. Emily tries to express some doubts about having kids, particularly with their very busy schedules, and Paul pushes those doubts aside, assuring her that they're going to figure out a way to make it work. Emily nods, but her eyes shout, "I have big doubts about having kids right now." But Paul doesn't see those eyes because of his singular baby focus.
You make it sound like he's just chasing after her with his winky out. Like, come on, baby, let's have a baby. Come on, baby, let's have a baby. Come on, baby, let's have a baby.
Every time they're together, he's like, and when we have our children, and when we have a baby, and when you get pregnant. Like, he doesn't have his, quote, winky out. But seriously, like, legit.
He has a theoretic winky out.
Every time they're together, he's got his, like, ovaries in overdrive being like, baby, baby. And, you know.
No wonder why she hides in closets. She's trying to get a break.
That evening, when Charlotte is alone in her room, she pulls out her birth mother's paperwork and makes the call. She asks for Allison, and the person on the other end of the line says, yes, who's calling? Charlotte responds, your daughter. And there's a pause, and then Allison says, I'm so glad you called. Phew, so relieved. So relieved. So relieved.
Yeah. Yeah. Call could have gone so many ways.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The next morning, the family's getting ready for breakfast, but Charlotte is heading out. She asks her mom to borrow the car. I've got kind of a last-minute potential donor in Jackson. The sisters are disappointed. What about the scavenger hunt? And Charlotte asks if they could just take this clue without her. Before they can answer, Mom says, keys are on the hook. Good luck, honey. I hope they write you a big check. Charlotte drives, but she doesn't go to Jackson. She goes to meet her birth mother, Allison, in Baton Rouge. She walks up to a nondescript bungalow, and a woman answers the door who looks a lot like her and only slightly older. They gaze at each other for a moment until the woman asks if she can hug Charlotte, and she nods. And they share a warm embrace and go inside. Mm. They sit in the living room and get to know each other. Allison wants to know everything about Charlotte. What do? Where do you live? Charlotte tells her that she builds medical facilities around the world and hasn't had a permanent address in some time. Her birth mom nods excitedly. Well, you're just like me. I'm an antiques dealer, and I'm always moving around. I've been to Mexico and France and Italy. Heck, if my grandmother didn't leave me this house, I'd still be moving. It's the best way to live. They're both surprised that they have that in common. Allison tells her that she knew she was going to do big things outside of Mississippi, but Charlotte admits that growing up was nice in Natchez. It was a great place to have a childhood. Allison gets quiet and asks, did you have a happy childhood? And Charlotte tells her, absolutely, yes. I had loving parents, and they even adopted two other girls, so I grew up with sisters. Her mom says that she thought of her often throughout the years and wondered how she was and if she was happy. She was very young when she got pregnant with Charlotte and knew that she wasn't fit to be a mother. So even though she wanted to keep her, she knew that Charlotte deserved a good life. So she put her up for adoption. Aww. I was worried, Allison admits, that if we ever did meet, you'd be upset at me for giving you away. Charlotte leans in and quietly tells her mother that she gave her the best life possible and how brave it was for her to give her baby away. Her birth mother starts tearing up and admits it was one of the hardest things she had to do, which makes Charlotte tear up, and they both chuckle because they even cry the same. Allison seizes the tender moment and asks if she can be a part of Charlotte's life, even if it's in just a small way. She would like that. So her birth mom asks her over for Christmas Day. She has some good friends coming over in the afternoon, and she would love to meet them and eat some good pastries. Charlotte is in. You had me at pastries. Well, she had me at pastries, but Charlotte just wants to spend time with her mom. Meanwhile, Emily and Nora are back in Natchez trying to work out the last clue. It reads, a feast for your eyes and maybe even more. Every Christmas season, this mail is in store. Our table for five will now work for three. Make sure you order the Cherry's Jubilee. They both laugh because they know exactly where they need to go. A little cafe called Sun Up Sundown Easy. We are not telling Charlotte that we got an easy clue without her. And Emily adds, and that we got to eat the best po' boys in Mississippi. They beeline to the restaurant, order their food, and when they sit down to eat, Emily looks at her sister seriously and says, I know we promised not to talk about work, but I just wanted to say that I am so sorry I wasn't there when your cafe went south. Nora looks down. Oh, it's just embarrassing, she says, having a business fail. But Emily is still encouraging. Opening up a business is hard work, and she should know because she's an entrepreneur. But Nora's unconvinced. I just feel like the lost cause in the family. Emily sternly tells her, you take those words out of your mouth, which I like, and it's a phrase I'm going to adopt from here on out. Corinne, you take those words out of your mouth. What you did was brave, and honestly, I've always been jealous of you because you were so good at everything. A big rift seems to get smaller between them. Nora's eyes get a little glossy, and she says, thank you. That means a lot coming from you. Besides, Emily continues, just because somebody knows exactly what career they're going to have or what path they're going down doesn't mean that everything's perfect. Nora knows that that's a loaded statement and tells Emily, give, what's going on? And she finally reluctantly admits that she doesn't want to have a baby right now. And even though Paul's got his pecker out constantly and keeps trying to shove it inside of her. Okay, she didn't say that. Even though Paul's pushing for it, you can interpret that how you would like.
Push it.
Push it real good. Ooh, baby, baby. Baby.
Oh, baby.
Even though Paul's pushing for it, they've been talking about it forever, but her job is so demanding, bringing a child into the mix just seems overwhelming. Nora takes her sister's hand and says, not everyone could be a parent, nor should everyone be a parent, but you should really tell Paul how you feel. Like Dad said, the truth may be hard, but it always feels better afterwards. Emily agrees, and as the check comes along with the Cherry's Jubilee, Emily tries to pay, but Nora tells her, just because I'm unemployed doesn't mean I'm broke, and grabs the bill. And tucked inside is a little scroll, their next clue, and the girls cry giggly. Okay. Tucked inside is the clue, and the girls get giggly as they pluck it out and wave it in the air.
Woo! That's an interesting way to girls say something. Wild with Cherry's Jubilee and a clue.
Cherry's Jubilee and a crew.
Woo! Later that evening, Liam and Charlotte go parking in front of the town's centerpiece, the Longwood Estate, the Longwood Plantation, the Longwood Mansion, the big-ass, beautiful, octagonal house that is partially built by enslaved people and paid for with slave money. Yay!
I have a question.
Yes?
Why? Why are they just parked in front of the house looking at the lights?
This is my theory. Huh? This is like where people in the town go to have that magical Christmas experience, almost like a Christmas tree lane in most towns, but it's this mansion that gets decked out. However, I will say that the lights are weak, so they aren't that cute.
They're not that cute, and Christmas Tree Lane has multiple houses. There's like a whole couple of blocks usually that are like very vibrantly decorated. Is Natchez just a, like, we're going to do this one house and that's it. Don't ask us for any more or any less. You don't get to drive anywhere. You just park in front of this house and look at the lights. It's not like the Bay Bridge. And gentle listeners, if you haven't seen the Bay Bridge in San Francisco, you should check it out because it is a light show that is to be beheld.
Tamara and I held hands in cuddle while we watched it. It was really nice.
And sang Eternal Flame.
Yes.
And just to be clear, we are hetero life mates. We are not lovers because we cuddle and hold hands and sing to each other all the time.
Look, we're not afraid of our sexuality. We know our boundaries. We may spoon, but we don't make out.
And I still wouldn't hold your hand. And you do not spoon. Stop it.
We don't
spoon. Would not do any of that in front of that house. I would be like, I am not compelled to do any of that. I would just be like, oh, okay. Can we go now? Like, but not Liam and Charlotte. I'm sorry.
No, I personally think that they needed to up the Christmas decor ante to make that scene work. But they did what they did. It is what it is. They're sitting in a red classic convertible car, and they express, Charlotte and Liam express how they had feelings for each other in their youth and now. Charlotte invites him to come visit her on a belt sometime. He looks at her and says softly, yeah, maybe I will. She looks at him earnestly. The only problem is, if you come, I might not want you to leave. And they lean towards each other, getting closer and closer until they kiss as lights twinkle behind them. And it's a pretty sweet kiss.
Surprised. I saw those lights twinkling behind them and I'm like, oh no, kisses interrupt us. Here we go. Oh, the lights in my eyes. And then she's going to pull away and be like, we can't kiss now. My eyes wounded.
Nope. They went for it and they kissed and it was sweet. The next morning, Charlotte is innocently sleeping in her bed when she is suddenly pounced on by Emily and Nora, who are thirsty for the deets of her date last night with Liam. Charlotte is very kind and giddily fills them in when I would have told them to fuck off and wait until I was actually awake.
You wouldn't tell me if I pounced on you? I was like, great. crin, 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 crin.
No, I'd hit you with a pillow and be like, leave me alone. I'll tell you later. Wait until my eyes open on their own.
Then I'd just wait 20 more seconds and you'd be like, okay, fine.
Because you'd be awake already.
You would not be able to go back to sleep because I would be 2 inches from your face staring at you. I'm not saying anything.
Here's Johnny.
Wheat, wheat, wheat.
There would be no axes involved. Thank you very much.
You're more civilized than that.
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte is very kind and giddily fills them in. We kissed and it was wonderful. The sisters shriek. Nora jumps on the bed and dances, and Emily starts enthusiastically whacking Charlotte with a pillow. However, Charlotte is saved because their mom calls Emily downstairs. And now we have some prime awkwardness. Mom reveals to Emily and Paul the bassinet that Emily's mom and dad made when they started wishing for a family. Mom says that whenever their wish comes true and they're ready for it, she'll mail it. Paul is thrilled. And Emily is, thanks, Mom. A little later, Nora and Maisie meet up at a local store that has things sold exclusively that are made in Mississippi. They journey through the store having cozy conversation, and Maisie lets Nora know that she appreciates places like this because she's an artist, mainly acrylics, but also dabbling a little bit in watercolor. Nora is impressed and a bit envious that Maisie has found her calling because Nora admits to being a bit lost at the moment. Same, Nora. Same. Nora smiles warmly at her. I get it. Art is constantly about reinvention, so I'm always having new beginnings and finding my way. Just then, Maisie's phone pings. She looks at it and gets a panicked look on her face. Oh no, the time totally got away from me. I'm supposed to be meeting my mom for a carriage ride right now. Nora is understanding, and they share a warm hug and part ways.
Next, the sisters take their next clue to... And we'll find out after this break. And we're back. Next, the sisters take their clue to City Hall. The clue reads, the place where your births were recorded on Christmas not far apart. Thanks to our hopes and prayers, we became a family under this chart. So, of course, their chart is at City Hall because that's where it was documented when they were adopted by their parents.
Aww.
On the City Hall steps, Emily looks a little down and Charlotte asks her, what's up? She admits it's been a weird morning, and Nora puts her arm around her and holds her close because she knows what's going on. Charlotte says, maybe seeing Miss Gloria will help, and they all file inside. Inside a documents room, Miss Gloria sits them down and takes out a county docket where their father wrote down his 3 adopted daughters' names himself. The girls look at it with reverence. They've never seen this before. Miss Gloria offers to make them a copy, and Nora whispers, there's no clue here. They agree to the copies and ask if there's anything else she has to give them. Miss Gloria's confused. Should I? She asks, but they realize quickly that she's not in on it, and this is not where they'll find their next clue. They reconvene at their scavenger hunt headquarters and try to figure out where they went wrong. That's where their names were recorded. They assure each other they did everything they could. Miss Gloria's going to contact them if she finds anything. They left a message at the front desk and for anybody that wasn't there that day, just in case. But they're still at a loss, and Emily suggests that they take a break. Charlotte is adamant, we have to find that clue today! This seems kind of hypocritical since she left them the prior day to find the clue themselves when she went to go find her birth mother, but I'm just saying. Emily raises her voice. There's more important things than just this scavenger hunt. She slams her notebook down on the table and leaves in a huff. In a huff!
Ha!
And Nora chases after her. Charlotte looks after them confused. What the fuck was that about? Until her phone rings. It's Allison. Her birth mother's plans have changed, and her and her friends are going to mix it up and drive down to Biloxi on Christmas morning. She wants Charlotte to join them, but that's a big ask, leaving your adopted family on Christmas Day. Charlotte is warmed by the invite, but asks if she could think about it. She's got some things to work on. Allison understands and says she hopes they can meet up, and she really wants Charlotte to meet her friends, and her friends definitely want to meet Charlotte. Yeah, I was like, oh, honey, that's in poor form. I just met you the other day, and I know that you have this adopted family that you spent years and years and years on, but why don't you just pull away from them and come spend Christmas with me and my friends?
I completely agree. I was like, that's a lot.
When she said afternoon, like you can have the morning with your family, yeah. exchange gifts, and then oftentimes people will go to different houses yeah. to spend the holidays with different family members. So I'm like, okay, that's feasible. But then when she's like, we changed our plans. Now we're going to go to Biloxi on Christmas morning.
Biloxi is 3.5 hours away driving.
You want to spend 3.5 hours in the car with your birth mom and her friends that you never met before? Nope. No, I don't. Later that evening, Charlotte is in the shop planking a piece of wood. Leon comes in and asks if she needs help, but she's just doing a little project for her mom. But the real reason he's there is because he's got a gig at Smoot's and asks Charlotte to join him and maybe they can get food beforehand? Like a date? She agrees, and he notices there's something off about her, so she finally tells him that she made a mistake. She lied to her family and went to go meet her birth mother in Baton Rouge. But she was great, she gushes. We really got along. So, Liam asks, when do you think you're going to tell your family the truth? Do I have to? Charlotte asks. I mean, right now, do I really have to? He encourages her to do so. It seems like the right thing, and she's taken aback. I thought you would be happy for me. He tells her he is happy, but her keeping a secret doesn't seem like the right thing to do. Charlotte, on the other hand, knows how the Daniels family is and how hard it'll be to tell her sisters and her mom, and she's just not in a hurry to do it. Liam says he's just trying to help, and Charlotte asks for some alone time. He turns to leave, and she utters, I can't do this. And he comes back over to her, possibly to embrace or comfort her, and she stops him and clarifies, this. She points between the two of them, meaning whatever happened to them in the convertible in front of the lit-up mansion might have been a bad idea. Especially, she continues, since I don't even know what I want right now. He nods sadly, but seems undeterred. You know what you want, he tells her, and I'm just going to give you the space to make sure. Back at the Daniels family, Emily has solicited the help of Paul to set the table for Christmas Eve dinner. The families use a special holiday plate, and he marvels at them and says, Oh, I love these. We should get some for our family when we have one. And Emily can't hold a secret any longer. She puts a plate down and looks at him seriously and finally says, I don't know if I'm ready to have a baby, Paul, and I can't stand you poking me all the time with your Peter. He admits that he saw this coming, and Emily says, it's just her work is so demanding right now, and she knows that they talked about it forever, but the door's not closed for kids. It's just not open right now. Paul soaks in the information and says, I gotta take a walk. Before he leaves, Emily puts her hand on his chest and reiterates that she loves him very much. He says he knows, but he has to process what she just told him and leaves. Mm-hmm. Once he leaves, Emily takes refuge on the porch with a warm beverage and looks out over the water. Mom comes out a short while later on her way to the store and sees her. She comes over and apologizes. Her mom radar has been off, but she gets the impression that Emily might not have been ready to receive the cradle she tried to give her and her husband. Mama Donna was so excited to be a grandmother that she might have jumped the gun a little bit, especially when she saw that Emily was less than thrilled with the gift. Emily's eyes water and Mama Donna asks if she'd like to talk about it. Emily nods slightly and then falls into her mother's arms and they talk it out on the bench on the porch in front of the water.
Upstairs, Charlotte is sitting in her room looking at a selfie of her and her birth mom when she glances up and sees a needlepoint hanging on the wall of all the girls' names and birth dates. It's a clue! She hollers for her sisters because she thinks she's found the next clue. Once the sisters are gathered, she takes the embroidery hoop off the wall and nestled in the back is the final scroll. It's the final scroll.
Designer scroll. Final scroll.
Emily reads. Head to a familiar oak. The bell is your last clue. Ring it on Christmas loud and clear if there's a wish you wish to come true. You girls are my most treasured wishes, the best gift I ever received. I love you now and always from Dad on Christmas Eve.
Oh, you motherfucker. That got me a little bit. I got a little teary-eyed there.
Yeah, I see you get a little teary-eyed.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, so tender.
God. I can't even imagine if my dad was like that, half that sentimental, I would probably still be a wreck. And he passed away in 2009.
I know that, like, if my sister knew that she was going to die, she would have, like, legit, I am sure she would have made, like, different notes and packages to, like, get delivered to me at different points in time.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah. Oh, feelings. Okay. I'm like, Dad. Oh, you and your misty eye message. The sisters have tears in their eyes. I don't know why. Touched by their dad's final message.
Tamara has tears in her eyes, too. Go figure.
Oh, I know. I think they should, like, frame that, like, final scroll. That would be really sweet. They made copies and framed the final scroll.
And I could just imagine that. Where's that final clue so we could frame it? Oh, shit, I'm sorry. I threw it away. I spilled some coffee on it and, like, you know, started wiping the table up with it. And that was kind of fright. That would totally be Charlotte. I don't know. Like, I'm seeing Charlotte doing something like that.
Oh, Mom was asking about recycling. And I was like, oh, yeah, I've got this. And with that knowledge, they get on their bikes and head to the same park and the same oak tree where we first saw them as girls. Once they get to the tree, Nora looks up at it, pondering, I wonder if we'll still be able to make wishes without Dad. Charlotte responds, I don't know. We still gotta try. The sisters elect Charlotte, the tallest of the bunch, to grab the bell. They give her a bit of a boost, and Charlotte grabs it. They all gather around, looking fondly at the bell, when Charlotte's phone rings. She pulls it out and looks at it, and it says Allison. She hits ignore and puts it swiftly back in her pocket. But Emily and Nora's sneaky sister Sniffer is well-tuned. Emily asks, Who's Allison? Charlotte briskly responds, No one. Nora raises an eyebrow. It's programmed in your phone, so I don't think it's no one. Charlotte tries brushing them off again. Guys, I don't want to talk about it. Emily says, smiling, Why are you being so weird? Charlotte refutes, I'm not being weird. I'm not weird. I'm not being offensive at all. Emily and Nora say, You're being weird. Charlotte admits, It was my biological mom. I didn't go to Jackson to meet with a donor. I went to meet her. Nora looks hurt. You lied? Charlotte says, I was going to tell y'all. I just wasn't sure how you were going to react. Emily and Nora are hurt, and even though Charlotte tries explaining that it doesn't have anything to do with them, she's always wanted to connect with her bio family and always felt that there's a part of her that's missing. Emily and Nora feel betrayed by the sister that is most absent in their family. Nora says, The only part of you that's missing is the part you want to be. They ride off and Charlotte calls after them. Wait, let me explain. She hops onto her bike to follow. And when she goes to put the bell in her bike basket, it hits the edge and ends up falling on the ground and breaking. Back at home, the sisters sit in the living room.
Wait a second. Let's just unpack that a little bit.
Okay.
The sisters get mad.
Uh-huh.
It's not about you. She wants to find her birth family. Like, you are still her family. She's not replacing you. Like, yeah. Why don't you let her do her just because it's not in the same beliefs that you have? And the fact that they get so disgruntled just really, like, chapped my hide.
I think it's twofold. I think that she's been so distant from the family that it just makes them feel like she'll be more distant. And so there's that. And also the fact that she lied about it, which was just, like, weird in the first place.
Because of the way they were acting. The way they acted, I'm like, I would have lied to your asses too. Allison who? Oh no, that's Al Ison, my ex-boyfriend. I stopped talking to him. I told him not to call. I have a restraining order. Don't worry about it.
I don't know why she didn't bring it up though when she's like, have you guys ever contacted your bio parents? And Emily was like, no. But Nora was like, yeah, in college I did, but I'm not in touch with them anymore.
Yeah.
Because then she could have just been like,
yeah,
well, you know, I'm finally deciding to reach out to my bio mom now, blah, blah, blah. Like, that was like the perfect timing. She created the intro and she just, instead she's like, I'm going to Jackson to do this thing.
Fair point. But what if she met her birth mom and she was like some cracked out, like crazy pants lady with 75 cats and was just like, oh shit, like back away, back away, back away, back away. And then she's like, okay, that didn't work out.
Yeah.
I didn't need to meet this lady. Yeah. I did. I know, but I don't have to tell anybody. And it would just have been easier on her.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of what I think she was doing. Like if I don't have to have the hard conversation, totally. Why am I going to have it?
Yeah.
So, but then after she met her, okay. That's all I have to say about that.
Yes.
Yes. Moving. You get it.
I totally get it. Back at home, the sisters sit in the living room with the cracked bell sitting on the table in front of them. They finally have that heart-to-heart that they've been so needing to have. Their dad's absence and grief has had a ripple effect in their lives, and they realize it's not for the better. Charlotte apologizes once again, but this time specifically for being absent in their lives. Part of her relentless traveling has been to avoid going back home and facing her life without Dad. She hadn't been present in the lives of her sisters because it was just too painful for her. Emily apologizes for eloping. She really missed having her sisters there, but didn't invite anyone because the thought of getting married without her dad being there was something she couldn't fathom. And Nora apologizes for being so distant. When she had to go back home after her business folded, her sisters' successes were hard for her. She felt inferior, was resentful of their success, and she blamed them. But being together made her realize they're all equal. With their triangle of pain complete, they look at each other with hard eyes.
Triangle? Get it?
Triangle of pain. Ring a ding a ding a ding a ding.
That's our metal band.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You know what the most metal instrument is? The triangle of pain.
Yeah. Triangle of pain. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding.
Oh, my Christ. That look on your face. Oh, so intense.
God. You felt that shit. You really felt that shit.
Oh, we've all had our triangle of pain moments. Of course I felt that shit. They pick up the bell, their hands on top of each other for a final wish, and Nora snakes the bell. I'm first, she yells triumphantly. Everyone laughs, and Nora gets ready to make her wish. And the sisters all know that Dad, once again, had a wish granted by the bell because it helped to bring them together again.
A little later, Charlotte calls her birth mother, Allison, and tells her sadly she has to turn down the invitation. She's going to spend Christmas with her family. Allison understands, and Charlotte says that she'd love to have her in her life, but maybe they should take it step by step, and she'll contact her after the new year. Allison's super understanding and says she would like that, and they get off the phone. Meanwhile, Emily needs to clear the baby-making air with Paul. She finds him on a park bench, and he thinks he looks so fine, she grabs him and pulls him behind a bush and screws the shit out of him.
Ooh, Hallmark, you've gotten a little wild on us.
That would be what happened in my head, but no. Kidding. She sits beside him, and I should probably say that Paul is at the gazebo where Santa is seeing kids and getting their Christmas wishes. And he explains that he's waiting for the line of kids to thin out from Santa so he can get a selfie with him. Probably not the best place to wait, Paul, being a grown-ass man staring at kids seeing Santa. I'm just saying. In this day and age, you might want to be someplace else. Emily apologizes again, and he's had time to process and tells her that he knows that they're not on the same page about having kids right now, but they are on the same team, so he'll wait until she gets on the same page as him. She agrees and says, let's see where we're at next Christmas. Their hearts and their eyes, and she says her Christmas wish is to continue making him happy year after year. And he smiles back at her and says he is happy because they're together. Aww. And they kiss and cuddle on the bench in front of all the children, and I'm sure quite a few parents were relieved.
At the wood shop, Mom is fixing the bell while Charlotte watches. Mom says, it'll have a little crack, but it'll still ring. Can we just take a moment to say it's a wooden fucking bell and it rings like it's metal? Okay, done with that. Now, sure.
Also want to say that all the times that bell's been stuck in crevices and God knows where for their scavenger hunts, and the one time it barely hits the floor, like from 3 feet up. Oh, crack. Oh, my God. Like, that thing is a delicate little damn flower, and it really should have lasted through that fall.
Yeah, well, you know, by this point in time, it's like 40 to 60 years old, so.
Well, then it still sounds like metal. Okay, we'll go back to that.
Charlotte, satisfied that the bell isn't beyond repair, changes the topic. You were the one hiding the clues, weren't you? A look of surprise flashes over Mom's face, and she chuckles. You girls are so hard to stay one step ahead of. I don't know how your dad did it. Charlotte smiles sadly and brings down the mood. I have something I need to tell you. I didn't go to Jackson the other day for work. I went to meet my biological mom. Mom continues to look down at the bell repairing it and responds, "Really?" as she processes. Charlotte apologizes for lying, but she didn't know how to talk to her mom about it. Her mom puts down the bell and looks at her daughter. It must have taken a lot of courage to reach out to her. Relief washes over Charlotte. "Are you upset?" she asks. Mom replies, "You know, I'm sure every adoptive parent feels differently, but I'm glad you had the chance to meet. If I were you, I would want to. You are so much like me. I just wish I'd known. I would have had you send my gratitude to her." Tears well in both of their eyes, and Charlotte says she'll let her bio mom know, and the mother and daughter tell each other that they love each other so much and give each other a beautiful hug. That evening, as the sun sets, Nora goes to Maisie's house to bring her a little Christmas gift. She knocks on the door, and when Maisie comes out, Nora thanks her for their talk the other day. "I may not know what I'm doing with my life, but now I know it's okay and I can do it with joy. I'd really like to see you in New Orleans and see your art." Maisie looks at her with hard eyes. "I'd really like that." Nora bounces a little on the balls of her feet and thrusts out a small white box towards Maisie. "Is it a ring? Is she proposing? I mean, it is."
"Too soon. Too soon."
Nope. Maisie opens the box and it's a Natchez souvenir ornament. Yay! She looks up. "I love it." The KISS tractor beam is on, and Nora and Maisie move towards each other.
Well, I'm sorry, I was making a KISS tractor beam noise.
I know, it was beautiful.
Is that distracting?
Well, I was just enraptured by it.
Okay, I'll
and
stop.
They share a lovely, short, soft kiss. And then I'm like, okay, so Maisie just moved to Natchez and her mom came and visited her. And now I'm like, are they in an Airbnb and she actually lives in New Orleans? I'm a little confused about the whole living situation because they make it seem both ways. I don't know. Yep,
they sure do. Because she said she knew everybody in town except for Maisie, but she's fixing that. And I was like, well, knowing everybody in town implies that they live there, not that they're just visiting. Yeah. Because you don't just saunter up to somebody who walks into the city limits and, "Hey, I haven't seen you yet. What are you doing here?" "I'm just getting gas. I ran out in the other county. Sorry."
They're hanging out in front of the one tourist attraction, the Octagon House. She's like, "You're new, and you're new, and you're new. Let's meet." She golden retrievers
and
it on up.
That's why tourism is down in Natchez, Mississippi. It's finally Christmas Day. Everybody in the Daniels house files downstairs. There's presents under the tree, and everyone takes a turn shaking wrapped boxes before filing into the kitchen for Christmas breakfast. And for a change, Emily's making snowflake pancakes instead of Paul, much to everyone's dismay. Except for Mom, who is a good sport and says she likes her pancakes crispy. Suddenly, everyone realizes that Charlotte is gone. Where'd she go? Why, she's out to make amends with Liam. She finds him on Santa's steps at Christmas on the waterfront, strumming his guitar. She hollers, "Is that Liam with the famous Natchez nachos?" He puts his guitar down and smiles. "Depends on who's asking." She tells him she is his biggest fan and that he's been her best friend for as long as she can remember. And thinking of him in any other way was hard for her to deal with, especially with everything that was going on with her family. But she wants to see where this could go. Liam looks a little dubious and tells her she can't mess with his feelings, especially not on Christmas. He's teasing her but gets serious and asks, "So you want to see where this goes?" She nods her head and smiles. "It's what I wish for on the bell." Their lips get closer. And he says, "This is what I wish for, too." And they kiss. And it's a nice one. But where their kiss is like a 5, maybe a 6 on a hot scale, the lesbian couple was like a 3.
Yeah.
Can we get a little more gay mushed face and maybe some tongue? Like, is that a little too much to ask? Because they're just like pecking like, mwah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Finally, it's later on Christmas Day, and everyone is at Christmas on the waterfront. Ooh. While Liam is announcing the brand new display that they're unveiling, made by the uber-talented Donna Daniels. Ooh. She stands in front of the large covered square and wishes everyone a Merry Christmas. She dedicates the piece to her 3 wonderful daughters and her husband, Robert. She pulls off the cover to reveal a living room scene, complete with a Christmas tree and fireplace. And front and center, there is a huge swinging bell. The diorama is labeled The Wishing Bell on top and in loving memory of Robert Daniels on bottom.
Aww.
The family gathers around Mom and they share a group hug. Everyone but Maisie, who stands off to the side and gives Nora a tentative wave. And the camera pans out to show all the wonders of Christmas on the bluff with the Mississippi River behind them. The end.
Yay! Woo!
Woo! Corinne?
Yes?
How many dry kisses do you give every time a bell rings?
Okay. This is what I'm going to say. I'm going to give this... This is so stupid. I'm going to give this 3.5 dry kisses. It is a 4 dry kiss movie. I understand that. But in the echelon
you better explain yourself.
Christmas movies in my heart, it is not anywhere near the top.
Oh my God. I can't even with you right now. Continue.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very well done. I thought it was one of the better done Hallmark movies of all time. But it just didn't have like the sweet romance plot line that I come to these movies for. So the Liam one was a little light and the lesbian one was sweet, but can we talk about that pad kiss, that kiss, which was fine because their lips were extended. It was soft. It didn't look like they were like mashing together their faces in pain, but it was, I wanted a little action and there was, and it was just like, it was like a little longer than a kiss that like people who kiss each other to greet each other, which I don't do that, but people do. And it was just like a couple of beats longer than, than that. So it wasn't much of a kiss. And like, it would have been nice if they had actually kind of gone out on a date versus being like, we're in a souvenir shop.
Oh yeah!
And here's this ornament, this Natchez ornament that I am giving you as a gift. I was like, wow, sexy. So
it wasn't even very cute.
No, it wasn't. It was that ornament. It was not cute. I totally thought that it was very magical how they wove all three of those very rich storylines all together, and that mom was badass. Okay, I'm going to move it up to 4 dry kisses. Fine, you've convinced me.
Thank God. Thank God. I'm like, I cannot. Okay, yes. Get it. Yeah. It still sounds like a 4 dry kiss movie, and you're not convincing it should go down a whole half a star. She said, bring it on up a little bit. I mean, you don't. It's your opinion. You can do with it what you want, but I'm just saying.
Okay, what about you? What do you give it?
I'm giving this movie 4.5 dry kisses.
Oh!
I agree with what you were saying in some of the aspects. It was not lovey-dovey as much as I would want it to be. There were some kind of convoluted things are going on. But that being said, I really enjoyed this movie. I thought the stakes were high, which you know I love.
Yeah.
I liked the layered storylines that all had a beginning, middle, and end. I love the sister dynamic. I love the fact that you can see the friction. And there was a point where I was like, okay, that's fucked up, Charlotte. Like, I'm not even in this, and I see that that's fucked up. So, like, all of that friction and turmoil and conflict, like, seemed real. And I enjoyed that without, like, making it overt, like they weren't like pulling each other's hair and going on about things. So I thought that was a really smart way to do that. I love the dad storyline. I love the familiar storyline, and I love a good scavenger hunt. I never knew. Like, I want to get on my bike and somebody give me clues so I can go find some shit, like the Scooby-Doo gang. Like, that was my dream growing up, and it was a dream I never knew I had, but I did, and I want it now. So if anybody in there in the podcast world wants to make that, actually don't do it, because that would be kind of creepy if I just saw little squirrels popping up. I would think somebody's trying to kill me. But anyways, that being said, like the storyline, like the characters, the diversity was good, like the drama, I'm giving it 4.5 dry kisses.
Nice. Now, what movie do we have coming up next week, Miss Tamara?
Next week, we are doing a Lifetime movie. Oh.
Ooh.
And it's called Under the Christmas Tree.
Hey, this one has a harness joke in it. Ladies, it's lesbian love. It's got Ricky Lake. It's going to be a good one. I'm super excited. And if you have anything you'd like to say about Under the Christmas Tree or every time a bell rings, or anything else, feel free to email us at onedrykiss@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on social media via Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, all at onedrykiss.
And that is one spelled O-N-E. And as always, if you have the time, we would love to see your ratings and reviews anywhere that you listen to this podcast. We'd like to thank you for stopping by and finding out what happens every time a bell rings. And we hope you join us next time. We bid you adieu with one dry kiss. Mwah. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Okay.
Woo!
Too bad we don't have a soundtrack to this episode. And on ODK soundtrack, every time a bell rings, hear the classic songs Triangle and the ever popular classic Sand.
Gentle listeners, can you believe these are all original songs? I know. It's hard.